Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Imbolo Mbue, author of Behold the Dreamers, a compulsively readable debut novel about marriage, immigration, class, race, and the trapdoors in the American dream. The unforgettable story of a young Cameroonian couple making a new life in New York just as the Great Recession upends the economy. Thursday, March 15th at 6:30 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 366 for Thursday, March 8th, 2018.
Today, I have instructed Secretary Moyer to immediately shut down the Baltimore City Men's Detention Center.
Remember that? That was Maryland Governor Larry Hogan in July 2015, closing the old, decrepit, and scandal-ridden city jail. While it was a city facility, the state had been running it since 1991, though, as things turned out, by the time Martin O'Malley was in his second term as governor, the Black Guerrilla Family Gang was pretty much running the place. And when he announced the closure of BCDC, Larry Hogan, a Republican in his first year in office, almost couldn't resist taking a shot at his Democratic predecessor.
Inmates were literally running this prison. Making matters even worse, a number of employees either stood by or in many cases enabled these criminals and the vast corruption that quickly followed. Maryland taxpayers were unwittingly underwriting a vast criminal enterprise run by gang members and corrupt public servants. Ignoring it was irresponsible and one of the biggest failures in leadership in the history of the state of Maryland. So far, 44 people have been indicted on charges of racketeering, conspiracy, distribution of drugs, money laundering, and this includes dozens of correctional officers. When the first indictments came down, the previous governor called the case a positive achievement in the fight against gangs. It was just phony political spin on a prison culture created by an utter failure in leadership.
It might be hard for Baltimoreans to remember anything that happened here before the death of Freddie Gray in 2015, but just a couple of years earlier, the BCDC brought Baltimore and Maryland to national attention for, as we've grown accustomed to saying in this town, all the wrong reasons. In April 2013, federal prosecutors indicted inmates and corrections officers, 13 of them women. The COs were accused of smuggling cell phones, tobacco, drugs, and other contraband into the jail. Gang members dined on shrimp and enjoyed Grey Goose vodka and cigars. They extorted fellow prisoners and ordered a tax on witnesses. Tavon White ran BGF inside the BCDC, and he was able to communicate with gang members outside the jail. During his reign at BCDC, the BMOC got four correctional officers pregnant. White later flipped and became the Fed's key witness. 40 of the 44 defendants in that federal case were convicted on racketeering conspiracy. Three were acquitted and one died. But that wasn't the end of Maryland's problems with corrupt correctional officers and prison gangs.
It is the largest case ever filed in federal court here in our state. 80 people have been indicted in connection with a drug and contraband smuggling ring at the Eastern Correctional Institution in Somerset County.
This trafficking case involves 18 correctional officers, 35 inmates, and 27 people on the outside. Now, most of them were arrested today and brought before a judge here at the federal courthouse.
What they involved was correctional officers taking bribes in return for bringing drugs, phones, and other contraband into the prison and providing those items to the inmates. In this case, there was no single gang that monopolized the corruption. Instead, there were prison gangs, many prison gangs operating within CI were empowered by this enterprise.
The going rate for bringing a package inside the medium security prison was around $500, and the items were sold for a massive profit. We're told officials were initially tipped off about this smuggling ring by a correctional officer at ECI, and that higher up administration had no knowledge of the smuggling ring.
That was a WMAR TV report on the indictments announced in October 2016 by then U.S. Attorney, now the Deputy U.S. Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, of corruption charges at ECI on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Most of the defendants pleaded guilty, though last September the government brought new charges against 14 of the remaining defendants. The charges include racketeering, conspiracy to distribute and possess drugs, and money laundering. There's a backstory to how the ECI and the BCDC cases came together for the feds, and it involves another gang.
Maryland, 2008. Dead Man Inc., or DMI, a brutal prison gang, had taken hold of the state's prisons. Membership had grown too big for the gang's leaders to control, and members were now turning on their own.
That was a blessedly brief excerpt from a pretty bad, believe it or not, History Channel program on Dead Man Incorporated, or DMI, a prison gang that formed on Maryland's Eastern Shore in the late 1990s. As you'll hear, it was the federal investigation of DMI that led investigators to the corruption at BCDC and at ECI. It also led to many guilty pleas, the breakup of the gang's leadership in Maryland, and the exoneration of two men who had been wrongfully convicted of murder. Quick story how I got into this. I was nosing around recently asking about assault weapons after the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida. While I was getting information about Maryland's ban on assault rifles, the state police told me about an arrest they made in February on the Eastern Shore in Wicomico County. They were investigating a guy suspected of converting semi-automatic rifles to fully automatics and selling them. On February 9th, they stopped one Dana Lank, 38 years old, for a traffic violation, and they say they found an SKS assault rifle in his car. Then they searched Lank's residence in Willards, Maryland, and another in Berlin. They say they found a modified, fully automatic assault rifle, a sawed-off shotgun, a .357 Magnum revolver, another assault rifle with no serial number, various rifle and shotgun parts, and five ammunition cans filled with rifle and shotgun rounds. Lank is charged with the illegal possession of an assault weapon, being a felon in possession of a rifle, and illegal possession of ammunition. State police identified him as a member of the Dead Man Incorporated criminal gang. And that got me wondering, whatever happened to DMI? And even before we get to that, how did it come to be?
I know its origins were in the late 1990s in prisons on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where Perry Rourke and James Sweeney and a guy named Brian Jordan were all incarcerated in state prisons.
Robert Harding is with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore. He supervises the criminal division, and he supervised the prosecutions of DMI members over the last several years.
They hung out with Black Gorilla family members, but they could not, of course, join Black Gorilla family. But they had a very close alliance with them. They did hits for the Black Gorilla family. The Black Gorilla family, when they wanted to punish someone, would look to one of these guys to do it for them. The Black Gorilla family enabled them to form their own white gang called DMI, starting in about 1999, with three supreme commanders, those three guys I just named, and many inmates, many of the white inmates in Eastern Shore facilities like ECI became quick recruits to this new gang because they knew by joining it they would gain two things, protection and access to drugs, which is very important for inmates.
DMI was sort of like a contractor for Black Gorilla family?
Originally, yes, that's right.
With the hits in prison?
Yes.
A hit could be actually killing someone or beating someone up?
Yes.
When did the U.S. Attorney's Office catch wind of what was going on here?
I think when a series of three murders occurred in 2009, the locals were having trouble making cases against them, and they brought the whole investigation to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and ATF brought it to my office to lead an investigation, and we put together the case that focused on those three murders, plus a bunch of other violent crimes these guys were continuing to commit. We did an investigation of Perry Rourke while he was still locked up in Supermax. We tried to intercept his jail calls. We even arranged to have a contraband cell phone smuggled into him. because we were going to listen to his calls that he made over the contraband cell phone. Unfortunately, that was the one time the prison officials there were really on the ball, and they found the contraband phone and seized it. So we had an early setback in our investigation, but we gradually, by flipping cooperators and listening to jail calls and making controlled buys from DMI members on the street, we pieced together quite a good case with over 20 cooperators that we put in the grand jury.
How did you get so much cooperation? That's a good amount of cooperation for a gang.
Yes, and of course it's surprising because DMI members swear upside down and backwards never to snitch on their colleagues, and yet they did. They were facing so much time basically on the charges we had against them that they knew they had very little choice. Most of the DMI guys we prosecuted wound up cooperating with them. We never had to disclose our cooperators because no one went to trial. All of these guys pleaded guilty ultimately, even took life sentences.
And those were for murder charges.
Yeah.
But there were also a lot of drug charges, is that
yes.
right? So this is interesting. So Rourke would kind of run things from prison using
yes.
this cell phone?
Yes. He usually had a contraband cell phone, even when he was in Supermax. And he would actually attend and supervise meetings on the streets of Maryland cities from prison by speakerphone. He would be on speakerphone at DMI meetings around the state and issue orders from prison. He did this for many, many months. And we actually had some cooperators who tape recorded the meetings for us and intercepted Perry Rourke's voice coming in over the speakerphone.
The orders he was giving for crimes, some of them were in Baltimore.
Baltimore is the center of DMI.
It was?
It was, yes.
A lot of these guys had Baltimore connections?
Yes. And Rourke wound up in Supermax in Baltimore. Like in around 2004, 2005, the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services moved Brian Jordan and James Sweeney out of state. But they moved Rourke to Supermax in Baltimore, thinking they could control him there, and instead his power only grew and grew because he was able to keep control over things by contraband cell phone.
What would they get out of this relationship with BGF? Would they get protection in prison? Would they be compensated?
Even though they began as a sort of close affiliate of BGF, they became, over the course of time, pretty independent. And no longer just did hits for BGF. They did their own hits. They had to discipline their own members. They had to enforce their own rules on people who owed them debts for drugs and that sort of thing. So they gradually, in some prisons more than others, broke away from BGF. And in some cases, they even developed rivalries or hostilities with the Black Gorilla family. So it didn't stay the way it had been at the outset.
In July 2016, a federal grand jury charged a DMI member, Troy Allen Lucas, in a murder-for-hire scheme going back 8 years. There was a homicide in southwest Baltimore on March 24, 2008. The shooting victim was a man named Robert Long.
Lucas killed Long because Long had testified against a DMI affiliate, a guy named Jose Morales, in a federal trial. Long was killed by Lucas, and Lucas himself was then prosecuted by my colleague Sandy Wilkinson just a year or two ago.
That case resulted in a conviction for Lucas and exoneration for a man named Demetrius Smith, who was serving life in state prison for the Long murder, a crime Smith did not commit.
We also exonerated a guy who was serving life for a murder he did not commit. It was a case where our DMI cooperators told us that the wrong guy had been locked up for this murder. It actually didn't have anything to do with DMI, but they told us that the wrong guy was locked up, and so we conducted a new investigation of that murder and discovered all sorts of problems with the state prosecution, and eventually the state prosecutors agreed to drop their charges, and he was released out of state prison.
Perry Rourke was known as The Rock. He appeared in federal court in Baltimore in January 2013, and U.S. District Judge Richard Bennett sentenced him to life in prison for his role in creating Dead Man Incorporated, along with James Sweeney. Rourke, who was 43 at the time, already had served more than 20 years in state prison for armed robbery and was just days away from being released in 2011 when prosecutors charged him in a killing from the 1990s in Anne Arundel County. But the Fed stepped in with a racketeering indictment that charged The Rock and 22 others with crimes including murder, drug trafficking, and extortion. Those investigations came about in part because the feds believed Rourke's release would spur growth of the organization on the streets.
He was locked up back in 1991 for a robbery that he committed. He was at that point, he only weighed 155 pounds or something. He became a power lifter in jail, and he became enormously strong, and this enhanced his image in the inmate population. He became a sort of charismatic leader. He also, we believe, killed two people who were inmates in those facilities where he was incarcerated back in the 1990s. There was an attempt to prosecute him for one of those murders in Anne Arundel County, which we basically superseded by taking over the whole case against Rourke. But he had become a violent, powerful guy in jail in the course of the 1990s, and in the late 90s was able to put together this gang, this white gang, which is perhaps the most powerful gang to originate in the state of Maryland ever.
I note from a Baltimore Sun story of January 2013, when he was facing sentencing, that Rourke appeared in court and tried to disavow or detach himself from DMI.
Yes.
Before he was sentenced. You remember that moment?
I do. I was skeptical at the time because I thought he was just trying to curry favor with the judge who was about to sentence him. But in fact, it wasn't like that at all. He was facing a predetermined sentence. He had agreed to a life sentence. And he has never, so far as we know, had anything to do with DMI since he got locked up. He is now in a federal prison in California and has nothing to do with DMI. James Sweeney, on the other hand, who was locked up in a federal prison in Texas, continues to try to assert a leadership role over DMI as he construes it. He calls it DMI United now, or he has another name, POA, which means power over all. And he distinguishes himself now from DMI. It's his brand of DMI is a white supremacist organization, so very different from the way DMI was in the beginning. And Sweeney is still a force and still a figure, and some people listen to him and read his writings and things like that, but Perry Rourke has dropped off completely.
I asked Maryland's Corrections Department if DMI was still around, and I was told that, quote, DMI remains a major presence in our facilities.
It's still continuing, yes, but not as much as it was in its heyday when Perry Rourke was running wild. Around 2009 to 2012 was the high point of DMI in Maryland. But all of these guys, the whole leadership was locked up for very long periods of time, and it's had a real impact on DMI's effectiveness. It survives as a prison gang especially, and you still hear about crimes being committed on the streets of Maryland cities by DMI members, but it's no longer the force that it was 5 or 6 years ago.
Robert Harding says the original DMI case put federal investigators on the path to even more corruption in corrections. It was a correctional officer in the DMI case who struck a deal and ended up working undercover for the feds.
I would say that together the state prison system and various law enforcement agencies and the U.S. Attorney's Office learned how important it was to attack prison corruption, and it was this case that led to the BCDC prison corruption case in 2012 and 2013, and to the ECI case about a year and a half ago. We arrested 80 people out at Eastern Correctional Institution. The reason is that to attack gangs, especially prison gangs like BGF and DMI, you need to attack prison corruption. It's through the prison guards, the correctional officers, that inmates get phones that enable them to communicate with their colleagues on the outside. And it's through the use of those phones that they're able to conduct narcotics transactions that result in correctional officers bringing drugs into the prisons. And that enables the gangs to thrive inside the prisons. And it enables gang members outside the prisons to make a lot of money. So by attacking prison corruption, we learned we could also attack the gang problem in the state of Maryland. And so we have done that systematically over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. One of the defendants in the original DMI case was a correctional officer. We took that guy, that correctional officer, and he pled guilty, and we used him as an undercover operative at the beginning of the BCDC investigation. So the DMI case led directly to the BCDC case. He never testified, so he's still secret.
Morning, everybody. We are here today to announce the indictments of 26 members of a Crips gang.
In November, Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch met with reporters to describe charges against yet another correctional officer, a sergeant of the guards at the prison in Jessup, and 24 others, civilians, inmates, and another CO, on charges of attempted murder, gang activity, prison smuggling, and misconduct.
It operated within prison walls and on the streets of Baltimore City and across Maryland. It was led by Correctional Sergeant Antoine Fordham. The gang is charged with smuggling contraband into prisons, distributing narcotics outside the prison walls, inside the prison walls, and using violence to further the interests of the gangs.
Among the charges against Fordham, he allegedly ordered an attack on a former Crips member who was gay. The prisoner was stabbed more than 30 times, but survived. Prosecutors also connected Fordham to the attempted murder of a man who was supposedly selling drugs in Crips territory in northeast Baltimore. Fordham was heard in a recorded phone call allegedly boasting of his success as a Crips chief. "The route I'm going," he said, "they're going to have to build a statue out there with my face on it." At the press conference to announce the charges, two men besides Brian Frosch spoke, Don Hibbert, the special agent in charge of the Drug Enforcement Administration in Baltimore, and Stephen Moyer, the secretary of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services.
"We in law enforcement perform our duties honorably and with dedication, are always shocked and extremely disappointed when a law enforcement officer violates the law by engaging in criminal activity. The DEA will always do our part to weed out those that stain our badges and our reputations."
I think everybody knows how long corruption has existed within this department, and it's because we hire bad people. One of the first things that we did that the governor signed into law was that anybody who applies to be a correctional officer now has to pass a polygraph. Does that present a challenge for us in hiring people? Yes, it does. But when you talk to the leaders that are in this room with me, they want us to hire better people to reduce the amount of corruption that is within the department. This is just the beginning. I mean, we had the case last fall, we have this case today, we have other cases that are coming, and we're not going to stop until we have pushed every lead that we have about corrupt officers still working for us.
Once again, here's Robert Harding of the U.S. Attorney's Office.
It's an ongoing problem, and the fundamental reason is that the profits are just unbelievable. We had a correctional officer testify in the BCDC trial that she was making $10,000 a week bringing contraband into BCDC. This is a lot more than they're making as public employees, and it's just very difficult for some people to resist that kind of temptation. And ultimately, if you can smuggle contraband in body cavities or using techniques like taking Suboxone strips and putting them in the soles of your shoes, there's no realistic chance that you're going to be captured coming into the prison, passing through the detection equipment and that sort of thing. So there's almost no risk involved. The only way to fight it ultimately is to make sure you've got honest people working as correctional officers and also conducting the kinds of investigations that we're conducting, which heavily depend on wiretaps. If we can pick up conversations where the correctional officers are doing their business with the drug dealers on the outside and the inmates on the inside, we can make cases against them and hopefully help to set an example for the others. But we'll never be able to stop contraband coming into the prisons, but at the entrances to the prisons by screening equipment. It's just not going to be possible. If we can cut off the connection between the gangs outside the prisons and the gangs inside the prisons, if we can break that contact, we will substantially reduce our crime problem inside the prisons and outside the prisons. And we can do that just by making sure that all our correctional officers are honest and responsible public employees. And if we can prosecute correctional officers who aren't that way and make an example of them, we will have successfully attacked our gang problem as well as our corruption problem.
That again was Robert Harding, an assistant U.S. attorney who supervises the criminal division of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore. In the notes with this podcast, you will find several links to Baltimore Sun stories by my colleagues Justin Fenton and Tim Prudente about BGF, about Crips, and Dead Man Incorporated. That's our show for today. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get a chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.